News. I'm Larry Miller in London.
General Motors says it has had its best full-year profit ever, but its fourth-quarter profit is lower than expected. The company says it's been doing well in the U.S., but its performance overseas has been weak. Japanese police have arrested the former president of Olympus Corporation and six other people over their alleged roles in a giant accounting fraud at the medical equipment and camera maker. Current Olympus management plans to step down in April. How the company will be managed after that and whether it will have to seek a partnership with another company or even a takeover are unknown. The nation's sixth biggest credit card companies report mixed results for customer payments in January. They say they've split evenly between those who had lower defaults and those with increased write-offs. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Lexus with the all-new 2013 Lexus GS, featuring a redesigned platform and drive mode select. Lexus.com/GS.
Hi, this is WILL Station Manager Bob Culkeen. Thank you to the 332 listeners who made a pledge of support during our February pledge drive. You raised more than $42,000 for WILL, your local public radio station. And thanks to the Common Ground Food Co-op, their partnership provides generous support to both WILL and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. This local partnership provides over 2,600 meals to local families.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating Part 5 of the complete Beethoven Quartet cycle on February 21st with Pacifica Quartet. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com or 217-333-6280.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we'll have another in a series of conversations that we are doing with candidates who'll be competing in Illinois' March primary, and we'll be talking with candidates for Congress and for the State House. And this morning, our guest is State Representative Jason Berrickman. He's a Republican. He is seeking his party spot on the ballot in the new 53rd district of the Illinois State Senate, and it is a big district. It stretches all the way from Bloomington on one side all the way over to the Indiana-Illinois border on the other, including towns like Pontiac, Eureka, Dwight, Paxton, Hoopston, Watseka, just to name a few. His opponent in this race is Shane Cultra. He is a state senator now, and he will be with us, by the way, next week on the show on the 21st, so you'll have the opportunity to ask questions from him as well. Our guest was sworn in to the State House in January of 2011, and he represents now the 105th Legislative District in Illinois. He was born in Streeter, raised on a family farm in rural northern Livingston County, graduate of Illinois State University and also the University of Illinois College of Law. He is an attorney and specializes in real estate law. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We talk, of course, questions are welcome. We hope that people who are in this district and will be voting in the primary will take this opportunity to ask questions of the candidate. If you would like to call in, the number here is 333-9455. That's here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Also, we do have email, and you can participate that way by going to will-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We do hope people will try to be brief just so we can get in as many people as possible. And Representative Berrickman, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Doing great.
Good.
Doing great. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Some basic things that we want to make sure we talk about, and the big things have to do with the state budget. Even with the tax hike of last year, the governor's office says that it is expecting a $500 million deficit this year. He's calling for a 9% cut in most areas of government except education and health care. And we know that the state has a big backlog of unpaid bills, $8.5 billion worth. So let me just ask as a basic question to get us started here. How do you attack this problem?
Well, I think the governor's right that cuts have to be part of any solution that Springfield comes up with. And I'm one of these who approaches state government with the mentality that there's always an opportunity to tighten your belt. And I disagree a bit with the governor's approach that there might be some sacred cows and that there should be maybe some parts of state government that are not part of the public debate on whether or not we can streamline and make some cuts. I'm a very big proponent of rank-and-file legislators having input to the budget and being able to put forward a number of proposals that might cut any area of state government. When you think about where our tax dollars go, to say that we need to cut the budget is really not even a totally fair description of what needs to occur, though. I'll give you an example about the Medicaid program that we have today. This fiscal year, our state will spend roughly $32 billion. That's roughly what was appropriated last year for this year's expenditures. Of that $32 billion, almost $15 million goes towards our state Medicaid program. And even if the legislature and the governor all agreed that we were going to cut the Medicaid program by an astronomical number, let's say billions of dollars, the reality is you cannot simply cut Medicaid. What you can do is reform the Medicaid program to decrease the number of people that are eligible to receive Medicaid or to decrease the number of services that are available through our Medicaid program and thereby limit the exposure, the liability that the state has to spend money within that program. Mm.
Well, let me ask you about that specifically, because clearly this is a big area that will be targeted. I think everybody knows that. And as you say, I think people say there are really three things that you can do to reduce the amount of money that this program costs. And you've mentioned two of them. One is to change the rules to affect eligibility, so fewer people are eligible. Another is to reduce services. And there are some things that Illinois provides that other states don't. There is one thing you haven't mentioned. You can reduce your reimbursements for providers, something that the governor, I think, has proposed and may propose again. Would you favor that?
I don't favor that. In fact, historically, what has happened has been a dramatic reduction in those reimbursement rates, the result of which is a cost shifting by hospitals and nursing homes and others who provide Medicaid services. What they do when the government reduces the and continually reduces the amount of payments that are made for reimbursements, what happens is the cost for those services, when the government's not paying 100% of the cost, that cost shifts to the private payers. It's like a tax. It's like government's not funding their full share of what they have obligated to pay. And so I do not favor that. And I think, unfortunately, our state has a history of simply reducing those costs time and time again and not addressing the core issue. And, to me, the core issue is who is eligible for these services and what services are we providing as a state. And we've not seen very much leadership from Governor Quinn to tackle either one of those issues, but I will continue to push forward on them.
Are there particular services that are being provided now that you would cut?
Well, certainly the Medicaid program is first of all governed by federal law. Federal law basically says that if you are going to provide Medicaid services for which the federal government will reimburse you for some amount of those, then there are two menus of services. There's what's called the mandatory menu, and then there's what's called the optional menu. And every state is required to offer those services that are on that mandatory menu. But what you have seen throughout the country is that in an effort to reduce the liability that exists within Medicaid, states are tackling proactively the optional services that are afforded to their Medicaid recipients. In Illinois, I certainly think that is the discussion that we ought to have. Unfortunately, again, we're not having it. Mm-hmm. Illinois today provides a number of optional services that we could certainly have a public debate on and determine whether or not those services should be continued.
Well, there are
I'll give you a specific example.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
A specific example is what's called the All Kids program. And All Kids has received a lot of media attention over the years. under the Blagojevich administration, the All Kids program expanded greatly its eligibility pool. All Kids provides health insurance to children. The intent of the program, and as any other program, you know, it has the greatest intention in the world. The intent says that every child ought to have health insurance. And I think that's a terrific goal and aspiration for us to have. But under All Kids today, a family of four making approximately $70,000 a year can receive free health insurance for their children. And to me, I think we've gone way too far when we're allowing those who make $70,000 a year to have free health insurance for their children. I think we can greatly reduce, whether we continue the program or not, we can at least reduce the that eligibility limit, the income threshold for which someone is eligible.
Mm-hmm. Where would you set that limit?
Well, I think that's why we have public debates. And the rather than me focusing on we have to be at X number, what I can tell you is that $70,000 is too high, and it's to me it's way too high. We are, as House Republicans, have continually put legislation forward and pressure, public pressure and otherwise, on our counterparts across the aisle to reduce that income threshold, and we'll continue to do so. And I hope that we can bring it down. Mm. You know, where we land, I certainly suppose, is up for some good, vigorous debate in Springfield, but we certainly need to bring it down. Yeah.
There are a number of other services that are provided that other states don't. There's dental care, there's in-home health care, there's hospice care, and there's the, apparently, as my understanding is, the most expensive thing is the prescription drug program. Would you cut any of those?
Well, I think everything has to be on the table. And as I think we all know, Springfield and state government, just like any other layer of government, needs to focus on solutions and compromise. And I understand that there are those in our communities today who say that these programs should not be touched. I strongly disagree with it. I think that we should put all the programs on the table. I think we need to have a thorough public discussion about how much of our dollars we can, quite frankly, afford to put towards the Medicaid program overall, and then we can enact procedures to whether it's eliminate some programs or reduce. Again, I'm a strong supporter of simply reducing the eligibility pool for a number of these programs that exist. You're absolutely right that prescription drugs is a major expense to our Medicaid system, and if there's an opportunity, again, to reduce the number of people who qualify for that, that's certainly what we should do.
Our guests, let me just introduce for anybody who might have tuned in. The guest in this hour of focus is State Representative Jason Berrickman. He represents the 105th Legislative District in Illinois. He is a Republican, and he is one of two candidates that will be competing for their party spot on the ballot for the new 53rd District of the Illinois State Senate. The other is current state senator Shane Coulter. He'll be on our show next week, so you'll have the chance to hear from him as well. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to come back to the problem of unpaid bills, which is really significant, and I'm sure a lot of the people that are owed are people who have provided various kinds of health services to the state. And it works a real hardship on people who are providing these kind of services to the state if they have to wait months and months and months for them to be paid. So we have a big problem here, $8.5 billion. How do we begin to tackle that?
Well, you know, the financial woes that our state has, and unfortunately our woes are significant. We have the largest deficit in the entire country. As an example, the problems that we have financially are problems that did not erupt overnight. I think most of the public knows that we have had a government in place that has made a series of financial missteps over the last 10 or 12 years. And I've really taken to studying the budget and trying to understand where our dollars have gone. I've only been in the legislature for a year, but what's clear to me is that our government has made one bad decision after another. And so to start, we need to start making good decisions. And give you an example of what has occurred just recently. It's an example of yet another bad decision made by Springfield. Our state government, after raising everyone's taxes last January to the tune of, you know, a 67% tax hike on individuals, fast forward to last fall, late last fall, you had a number of companies who were saying that they were going to leave Illinois if they did not receive a tax break. And I oppose that measure vigorously because I think it's unfair for our state government to pick and choose the winners and losers of our financial economy. Just because CME and Sears employ thousands of people in the Chicagoland area does not mean that they should get a tax break when everyone else is feeling the burden of a tax increase. But what our legislature did, again, they raised taxes on everyone. When a handful, three companies from Chicago, said their tax burden was too high and they were going to leave, the legislature quickly, over the course of about 3 weeks, carved out nearly $300 million in tax breaks to this handful of Chicago firms to keep them in Illinois. And that's a terrible decision, not only to the middle class and to the rest of everyone else who didn't receive a tax break, but it's also a terrible policy for our state. You know, what our state government really needs to do is simply create an environment where those who are in business in Illinois today want to stay, and those who are in other states looking to expand their business hopefully would look to Illinois as being a competitive state to attract those jobs that we so desperately need.
I want to come back in a moment or two, or at least at some point, I want to come back to business climate. But to go a little further on this tax and the issue of taxes, last year the General Assembly approved an increase in the income tax. It passed without any Republican votes. And you didn't have a chance to vote on that because you were sworn in after that was all done. I would assume that, like your fellow Republicans, you would not have voted for the tax increase.
That was actually my second day in office.
Oh, so you actually did vote on it. My apologies. So you did.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It was my second day, and it was quite a whirlwind day, and you're correct. I opposed that measure. And then when I opposed it, you know, part of my reasoning for opposing it was that I said that by raising taxes, Illinois is going to push jobs out of our state. And we're seeing exactly that. And again, what I disagree with is the notion that Springfield can just simply put a Band-Aid on those who are able to scream the loudest and keep them in Illinois. I mean, that is not at all a rational approach to governing. That is a management by crisis mentality. What Illinois really needs to do is enact long-term plans, long-term tax policy that fundamentally addresses the root issues and problems of our state that make us unattractive to business and, again, begin to attract those jobs that we need.
Well, on the tax increase, most of this is slated to expire in the year 2015, and there's some conversation, I'm sure, about whether it should be extended past that point. There are also some people who say it actually should be abolished sooner. Would you favor getting rid of it before 2015?
I certainly would favor getting rid of it. You know, I'm one of these who believes the sooner the better. The reality is, for our state government, if the funds are there, they'll be spent. What I would love to see us do, I think those who argue that you cannot lower taxes because of those unpaid bills, they're partially right. We absolutely need to, and again, going back to our early conversation, we need to do more than cut. What we need to do is reform those programs for which individuals automatically become eligible for state-sponsored services, and as a result, drive up our financial liability in our state. Medicaid, of course, being the big one. But, you know, our public pension systems have received a lot of discussion. I think there's an opportunity there for some reforms and beyond. And then as a third category, and the piece that is not drawing much attention but should, is that if we can create this competitive environment where Illinois becomes a place that attracts jobs, with those jobs becomes an opportunity to grow our state's economy. When you put people to work, when you start creating new jobs, not government jobs, but private jobs, putting people to work, those individuals begin to work, to pay taxes, and to produce. And the result is that Illinois grows its economy, expands its tax base, and has the financial dollars available that we need to work through some of these unpaid bills in there.
You know, I think that there are a lot of people in the policy arena that would certainly agree that we have to get spending under control. Spending must be cut. At the same time, there are people who said, but you can't deal with the budget problems without doing something to try to increase revenue. Now, I know that you've said you didn't vote for the tax increase. Do you see any possibilities? Is there some role here for revenue increases in dealing with the budget problems?
Well, consider this. Again, I truly believe that when we become competitive, we expand our tax base and thereby grow our economy. But consider this. When the tax hike passed, you know, there were a number of provisions to that tax hike. The one that we talk about most is that individual tax rates went up. But there was another piece that raised corporate income taxes. And corporate income taxes in Illinois now are the third highest in the entire country. The net effect, or the intended net effect, of the rise in corporate income taxes was to raise an additional $700 million a year. In other words, when corporate taxes went up, the economists said that the new tax rate would generate an additional $700 million in revenue for the state. That was a year ago, or a little over a year ago. And since that time, we've had two major moves by either the legislature or the governor that did nothing more than redistribute that tax increase back to a number of companies. Last summer, so again, mind you, the tax increase on businesses was supposed to raise $700 million. Last summer, the governor put together a tax relief package for Motorola and a handful of other companies. That package was estimated to cost the state approximately $200 million. Then last fall, like we've already talked about, CME and Sears came forward with their proposal. The result was the legislature gave them about a $300 million tax break. So what you have is, although taxes went up on businesses to the tune of $700 million, what we've seen is that the government is in the business of picking winners and losers, the winners being those companies that received $500 million in tax breaks, the losers being everyone who didn't. The net effect is that although they raised taxes $700 million, they've given back $500 million, and there's only $200 million left. A really foolish decision, I think, on the part of our government, and it really creates a hodgepodge of what our tax policy is. If you're this business or that business, you have a tax policy that's different than the next. And what I fear is what we're seeing is that companies doing what is in their best financial interest certainly are continually approaching our state government and saying, where's my tax break? And I understand it. I mean, it makes perfect sense that you would ask for that because our government's in the business of giving them out.
Let's shift a little bit to another big problem, and we just mentioned it in passing, so I want to make sure that we spend some time talking about it, and that is the pension issue. Illinois has one of the most underfunded pension systems in the nation. I think actually at one time it was declared the worst. I'm not sure if we still have that honor, but it's certainly bad. And the governor has said pension reform is at the top of his agenda for the year. Seems everybody agrees something has to be done. They just don't agree on what. How should we attack this problem?
First of all, I think you saw last year, and I truly believe through the leadership of our House Republicans, who are in the minority, we put forward some pension reform measures that passed, and they passed over the objections of Mike Madigan. I think that's very significant to note. There was a lot of media coverage about the idea that individuals could double dip in our pension out of two or more pension systems. There was the notion that someone could work for as a teacher for a day, then jump over to a union job, receive a greatly increased salary, and draw from the teacher's retirement system, draw a pension at this inflated union salary rate. So we put forward legislation last year that ultimately passed and curbed those abuses. And I supported those measures, and I'm proud that we were able to do that, again, even while we were in the minority. Today, there are a number of proposals out there, one of which is called Senate Bill 512, which for those who are stakeholders in the pension system, they are very familiar with Senate Bill 512. It generally creates three tiers of benefits that participants may elect to choose from. Senate Bill 512 did not pass, actually was not even called for a vote, but it received a lot of public discussion. Some form of that, I believe, will resurface again this year. I think for those who are stakeholders in the system, the opportunity is to have input to the solution that ultimately is put forward. Recently, I saw that the U of I's Institute of Government and Public Affairs actually put together a white paper that has a new proposal, which is kind of a blended proposal of a 401k type plan combined with a defined benefit plan like current participants have. And I think what we will see is that all these proposals will likely be kicked around quite significantly over the next several months. And certainly the hope is that we can come forward on a solution that reduces our unfunded liability and also reduces the annual contribution that the state must make to those public pension systems. Next year, again, if Illinois does nothing, our pension contribution, the state's pension contribution, will rise next year by about $1 billion. And whenever that happens, whenever you have an automatic increase in a payment like that, the dollars have to come from somewhere. And they're either going to come through another tax hike or through a cut to other services such as schools, municipal governments, and others.
So you just, as you said, one of the biggest suggestions here, or at least the idea that has been put forward, it's the one, Senate Bill 512, this would create this three-tiered system and that then workers would have a choice. They would either, if they wanted to maintain a high level of benefits, then they would have to pay more. If they wanted to pay less, well, then they would get less. Then there would be the option of the 401k. So here in this case, people have to make a choice. As you say, the folks at IGPA have come up with something that's kind of a hybrid. Do you personally think one or the other of those approaches is better?
Well, the IGPA one is very new. I mean, I read about it for the first time last night, and it is only in the form of an outline of a proposal. Mm-hmm. What I presume is that we'll look to move that forward in some form of a bill for which the details of it need to be fleshed out yet. So I'm very interested in continuing that conversation with IGPA. They one of the members at IGPA, the faculty at IGPA, forwarded that to me and said that we ought to take a look at this as an alternative to 512. I can tell you that in the IGPA proposal, I think they've done a very good job of outlining some goals that we should start with that are very good goals for us to have. One of the concerns I have with Senate Bill 512, as an example, is that it does not satisfy a goal of reducing state spending. In fact, 512 would appear to increase state spending towards our pensions. And 512 also only affects four of the five pension systems. There's five public pension systems. Senate Bill 512 only addressed four of them. It left the judges out. And I know that they left the judges' retirement system out of that bill as a tactical move because the thought was that the judges will be ruling on the constitutionality of it, and they didn't want to give the judges a reason to declare it unconstitutional. But to me, again, we need to set good public policy. And good public policy suggests that what's fair for one is fair for all. And as we go about these reforms, I certainly am convinced of the fact that we need to enact reforms for all five public pension systems and not leave the judges out, not leave the legislators out, or anyone else for that matter.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of Focus is State Representative Jason Berrickman. We'll talk some more with him in just a moment after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, presenting Classics 3, Moving Pictures, on Friday, February 24th at 7:30 p.m. in the Folinger Great Hall at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The symphony will feature classic music scores from films.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. A quick mention that tomorrow, well, let me do today first, the second hour today. We'll talk some more about water. Yesterday we had some interesting conversations about where our water comes from, how it gets into our homes, how the waste gets taken away. Well, in the second hour today, what we want to do is try to go to the source and talk a little bit about ultimately where the water comes from. And for us here in central Illinois, that's the Mahomet Aquifer. We'll talk about how it is we try to manage this resource in a sustainable way, and we'll have two guests, both of them from the Illinois State Water Survey, Vern Knapp and George Roadcap. And then tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, a show that we do every month, it's our regular program on financial planning. David Sinnoh will be our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. So any questions that you might have, very specific questions about your own investing and money management strategies, you're certainly welcome to call. You can get the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. You can follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. You can also find us on Facebook. In this hour of the show, we're having one in a series of conversations that we're doing with candidates who will be competing in Illinois' March primary. The guest this morning is State Representative Jason Berrickman. He is a Republican. He represents now the 105th Legislative District, and he will be seeking his party spot on the ballot in the new 53rd District of the Illinois State Senate, and it is a big district, stretches all the way from one end, Bloomington Normal, a little bit further west than that, all the way over to the Illinois-Indiana border. I think I read somewhere that it would take you 2 hours if you drove straight across. And it is made up of the 105th and 106th House districts, if that will help place you in the district. Questions are certainly welcome here for folks who will be voting in this primary. We want to give you a chance to have some access to the candidates, so questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have somebody here in Champaign County where we are to talk with. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I want to take issue with a commonplace of the discourse that you gentleman used, and I don't expect agreement from him, but I want to get it out there, which is this idea of the inflated union salaries. Now, there's a lot of inflated salaries. Most of them aren't unionized. What, just watching the university, the blooming of the upper ranks of the higher ups. Management, as they're called, is really really lousy, and there's a lot of double dipping and all sorts of graft, and people that are making too much. But that's not the commonplace. It seems to me the real commonplace is that people who are unionized haven't been getting increases in salary, haven't been, and don't really start from most of them don't really start from a high base rate. So I would just take issue with this idea that the common unionized worker is overpaid. I don't buy it, and many people don't. You probably will say that indeed it is true, but I think the corrupt pay and the double dipping and all the things we hear about are not they're emblematic, but they're not really representative of the rank and file, if you will.
Well, Representative Berrickman, you want to respond to that?
Sure, and I think the caller's right. I mean, I certainly did. I made no mention of some notion that he brought up that there was union workers are overpaid. My point was that there was a provision in the law that allowed, as an example, and the Chicago Tribune covered this heavily, but as an example, there was a provision in the law that would allow someone to work for one day in a $40,000 a year job as a teacher, and then move over to a union job where they would receive a greater salary than that. The example that the Tribune pointed out was an individual who was drawing a salary from a union over their lifetime that it eventually was an amount over $100,000. And at retirement, that individual, although they had only worked as a teacher for one day, that individual was able to draw from TRS, which is the teacher's retirement system, a pension for which their pension was based on their union salary. So I think the gentleman who called is absolutely correct. That is not a, I think his words were emblematic of a widespread problem, but it was a problem, and it's one that we addressed last year by saying that should not be and no longer is legal.
Well, let me ask you this question, because I think there are people who say that also we have a problem that the laws and regulations governing the pension system are extremely complicated. All sorts of exceptions have been carved out for people with connections and special interests. Do you think that it would be worth reviewing the pension, the entire pension system, how it's organized, the codes that govern it?
Absolutely. I think any area of state law, I have been a big proponent that we should be really looking through all of our school codes. You know, there's a number of mandates that have been placed on school districts through a pile of pieces of legislation and laws that are in place today. And so the opportunity for any area of our government and laws in place is to do an exhaustive review. I was excited that the governor talked about pension reform very recently. He's put together a task force. It's a bipartisan task force. It's got Republicans and Democrats as a part of it, and their role is to not only review the pension laws that are in place, but to put forward some very specific proposals as a result of the review, and I think that's a good step and a good first step by the governor.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We've got another here, Effingham, line number two. Hello.
Sir, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is that this entire situation, I think, is mischaracterized. It's continually talked about as something referred to as pension reform, and while I do agree with your guest that there are clearly some loopholes that need to be closed that allowed some of the abuses that he's described. I think those are loopholes, and those should be addressed. But to characterize this as pension reform, I think, is misleading, because reforming the system isn't correcting the problem that got us where we are. What needs to occur is funding reform. And the pension system was designed by agreement with the General Assembly and those that will receive the pensions and those who've paid into their pension. Those folks have all held up their end of the agreement. It's the General Assembly that failed to properly fund the pension systems in this state. And I think to say that now we have to address it in terms of either funding pensions or reforming pensions at the expense of not funding education, for instance, I think your guest said, if we can either fund pensions or we can fund education, these are the kinds of choices that the General Assembly has to make today. I don't think they would be in that position if the pension systems had been properly funded all along. So I think maybe the language that we use to describe it could be shifted, and if we could talk about funding reform as opposed to pension reform, I think that many people would have less anxiety about what is happening to their pension systems in the state. And I don't know, this sounds more like a commentary than a question, but if I could just get some commentary from your guest about that.
Yes. Well, how would you respond to that?
Well, again, people think that there's going to be these stark disagreements, but I think the caller is correct. And as I said earlier, I've been in the legislature for a year, but I've certainly watched what our state government has done historically. My mother-in-law is a retired teacher. Believe me, I know about the woes of our funding for our public pension systems. Just in the last 10 years, our state government has made at least two, if not three, decisions to skip the payments that they need to make. And on other occasions, the legislature, to make the payment, has just went out and borrowed the funds to do it, which is really just taking, it's like putting it on a credit card. Now we have to pay interest on something that we should have just paid back then. So the caller is absolutely correct. There have been total mismanagement of our state funding towards our public pension systems. And I remind those who are in private business, and there are many individuals in private business who are very, I would say, somewhat hostile towards public employees and the public pension systems. And I remind them that when anyone meets with their financial advisor, you know, when someone gets their first job and they're working, they meet with their financial advisor at 25 or 30 years old, and their financial advisor says, you need to set up a 401k, and they remind them that at every pay period or every month, whatever regular interim, they need to contribute towards that fund. And then they show them a graph, and the graph says, if you make your payments as we have outlined here, the result is when you retire, you will have this pool of money available at retirement. And then they show you another graph, and that separate graph says, this is what happens if you skip a payment. And when you skip payments, the effect of that skipped payment is a dramatic loss of funds that are available at retirement. Our state has made a crucial error historically in skipping payments, and again, that caller's absolutely right. The public employees should not be penalized for the state's mismanagement of their responsibility. But I'm, you know, we're all left with the reality of what is has been done, and we have what we cannot do is change the mismanagement of the past. But what we can start doing is making the right decisions as we move forward. And that's, you know, that's why I've said that the stakeholders to the public pension systems certainly ought to have input as to what the solution is to move forward. And the caller's right, reform is a big word. You use reform everywhere in Springfield. Pension reform, budget reform, business reform. It's just it's a popular word. But what I do know is that our state cannot afford to continually increase the amount of the state's pension obligation without either raising taxes again or making cuts to some other layer of government. There's only so much money that the state brings in. And so something is going to have to happen. And what I'd like to see is us put forward a plan that those who are stakeholders agree is a good plan, it's a long-term plan, and it takes into account the fact that our state employees have satisfied what they said they would do in working for the state and contributing towards their retirement, often and almost always, without having Social Security benefits available to them.
I want to, I want to thank the caller, first of all, and say that we just have about 10 minutes, a little bit less, left, and I wanted to see if we can get into a couple of other areas. There is a particular thing that I want to ask you about here that does indeed have to do with tax and tax policy. You have promoted a legislative proposal that would abolish the Illinois state estate tax, and it is really clear that your particular concern here is the effect of the estate tax on family farms. I'd like to ask you about this. I also have an email from somebody about this. Let me just ask first, as a practical matter, there is a certain threshold that an estate has to meet before you pay the estate tax. In the state of Illinois now, what is the exemption now for the estate tax?
Yeah, the exemption today, and it's been going, well, it's kind of moved all over the place, as a matter of fact. But it is $3 million today.
Okay. So $3 million. So in order to the estate, before the estate tax will kick in, you have to have an estate of $3 million. I'm sure that some people might look at this and say, well, rather than eliminate it completely for everybody, why not? Well, first of all, one thing that you could do is say, make it the same as it is on the federal level, which I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think that it's $5 million on federal level. So why not just raise it up rather than get rid of the estate tax completely?
Well, that's what I tried last year. In fact, I had pushed forward a bill that would at least, it's called recouple. It puts the state of tax law at the same level as the federal tax law, and I certainly would be supportive of that. Here's the difficulty, and this is a big concern to family farms, but it's also a concern to small businesses and family-owned businesses. Anyone who's involved in a small business knows that oftentimes there is a value to the business that greatly exceeds the cash that might be available at any given time. So you take family farms, for example. I do not believe that many people would think that a farm, that a farm family that owns 700 acres, it would be considered a large farm, a mega farm, or otherwise. In fact, 700 acres today is probably about the size of the average small family farm that provides enough income for a family of four. The value of land today has greatly increased over the last 10 and 20 years, so much so that land values, depending on your location, can reach $8,000, $9,000, and $10,000 an acre. So if you have a family farm, you're not in the business of selling your land. You're in the business of farming your land. But if Dad were to pass away and you own 700 acres and those 700 acres were valued at $10,000 an acre, suddenly your estate would be valued at $7 million just for the value of the land. And when you combine Illinois' estate tax with the federal estate tax, a $7 million family farm could incur a tax of hundreds of thousands of dollars or more.
Let me just ask you this. Again, forgive me because we're getting short on time, but this is a specific question that comes regarding this from somebody who wrote this as an email, raising this particular issue is whether or not the estate tax puts family farmers out of business. And the person writes this. They say that this experience comes from their experience as a realtor. Often the estate tax is represented as a threat to the survival of family farms. This person writes, their experience has been what causes farmland to be sold at the time of generational transfer of land is that the non-farming heirs want to cash out their inheritance, that it's not about the estate tax. And so the question is, can you point to any examples where a family farm was put out of business by the estate tax rather than by the non-farming co-heirs?
Yeah, what happens, number one, they're again correct that in a number of displaced heirs often will sell. And when they sell that land, they are susceptible to a tax on the sale. That's first and foremost. What often happens is that the family farm, if it does not necessarily go out of business, what happens is that you have to sell, as an example, an 80 acre tract of land to generate the cash needed to pay the taxes that are due at the passing of the father or the relative. And so it's again, if you owned a 700 acre farm and Dad passes away and you generate a $300,000 tax bill, the question is, where do you come up with $300,000? And too often, the answer is, you have to sell 80 acres to generate the cash needed to pay the government the bill that's due because someone passed away. And I think that's wrong. Everyone who owns a business or owns land has already paid the taxes on their acquisition of that property. And I think it's unfair for the government to double tax, to tax again, at someone's passing.
And you could not deal with this problem by creating this, rather than abolishing the estate tax completely, creating a special exemption that would cover farmland?
No, because this issue is bigger than farmland. It's most talked about with farmland, but the issue hits many, many small business owners. Mind you, there are over 1 million small business owners in the state of Illinois today. Those small businesses employ 5 people or less and are truly the economic engine of our state. And when I talk about making Illinois more competitive, one of the ways that we become more competitive is to allow an entrepreneur to build a business, to retire, to pass away, and pass that business to their next generation without the government having to tear it apart or force a sale of it in order to pay the taxes that become due because someone passed away.
Okay, we're getting down to our last couple of minutes here. I do want to try to include one more caller. This is somebody in Charleston, so we'll go there. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just want to point out that at the point of death,
the increase in the value of the farmland, they get stepped-up basis. So if the farmland, due to these subsidies, has tripled or quadrupled in value over the 40 years that the person was farming it, the heirs get taxed not at the increase in basis over the previous 40 years, but they pay tax on the difference between the day the person died and when the farmland was sold. So they don't pay that tax that American just described. And I would like for him and the Farm Bureau to show examples of farms actually having to sell land and breaking them up in order to do this. There's been a national challenge for them to produce these people, and it they can't do it.
Well, can you give a specific example, say, from Champaign County, of a case where this happened in the last couple of years?
Well, I'm sure we can, and I'd be glad to follow up with you and provide that to you. But to the point of the tax, yes, there is a stepped-up basis that may help defer some of the tax that's due, but there's still the imposition of the tax on the sale. And there is also another tax at the sale, which is what's called the Illinois transfer tax. So outside of even the estate tax, there is the tax on the sale of the land, potentially based on the value and potentially based on a stepped-up value, as the caller has talked about. But there's a separate tax that is based on the value of the sale that's called a transfer tax. Our state taxes in numerous ways. And again, what I'm trying to do is preserve that family farm, that small business, and limit the forced sale of that land or that business and the ability of that family to pass that to their next generation without government getting in the way.
Yeah. We have about a minute. You said earlier that in cutting the budget, everything should be on the table. The State Board of Education has recommended a modest increase in funding. What do you think about funding for education, and would you make any changes in state funding for education?
Well, yeah, again, everything needs to be on the table, and I unfortunately don't feel like we are at a time when we can talk about increased appropriations to agencies because the dollars just aren't there. What I would love to see us do is look at the numerous statutes that are on the books that affect our educational community, oftentimes impact our local school districts, and look to remove many of those mandates and burdens that are imposed on them. And by doing so, look at the cost savings that are available both at a local level and at a State Board of Education level, and look to those cost savings as ways to save our state money rather than simply adding more dollars to the State Board of Education and having them try to do more and pass more laws and mandates on our schools.
What about the legislative scholarships? Keep them, get rid of them?
Absolutely get rid of them. I've never given one of those out. I am a very big proponent of our MAP grants and MAP awards as a good independent way to help students obtain a higher education, an affordable one. But this notion that legislators should be given scholarships that they can dole out, we can't afford those right now. And you look at the corruption that exists. There's a number of legislators under federal investigation for giving these things out illegally. And I'm a co-sponsor of the bill that entirely does away with that program.
All right.
I'd love to see it gone.
We have to stop there. Representative Berkman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, State Representative Jason Berkman, represents the 105th Legislative District. He is one of two Republicans seeking his party spot on the ballot in the new 53rd District of the Illinois State Senate.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org.
We'll break for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
And at 10:59, this is Jeff Bossert with an update on the markets. Looking at Kansas City winter wheat for March, 676 and a quarter, that's 676 and a quarter up six. May wheat, 683 and a quarter up five and three quarters. March wheat in Chicago, 630 up four. And May, 637 and a quarter, now 637 up three. March corn, 634 and three quarters up seven and three quarters. May, 637 and three quarters up six and three quarters. July, 641. Up 7. September corn, 591, up 4.5. March crude oil, 102.13 up 33. March beans, 12.61 and 3/4 up 3/4. May, 12.68 and 3/4 unchanged. July, 12.77 and a half unchanged. August beans, 12.72 down 2. March bean meal, 332.50 down 30.